This episode is sponsored by FreshBooks. Check out their 30-day free trial over at freshbooks.com/TDI.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings season is underway. Retail stocks getting a boost. Record highs for markets as the U.S. dollar plunges. And our guest today, Danielle DiMartino Booth. All this and much more on episode number 543 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Andrew Horowitz here, your host of the show. Thanks for joining me. Appreciate you being here. It's now officially the start of earnings season. Yes, indeed. Here we are. We have the beginnings of the season, starting off with some of the financial companies, just a few majors last week, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo on Friday. But this week is going to bring a slew of earnings from many of the major banks and financial institutions. And then starting the week after that, we're going to be starting to see all of the companies start to just pour in. Now, estimates are for growth of about 10% or so for earnings this next quarter, and actually continuing to be significantly pretty good and better than we've seen for some time over the next several quarters. At least that's what analysts are telling us. We'll have to see how that plays out, because the basic issue that we have to remember when it comes to earnings season is it's not just the numbers. It's also the sentiment, which is good right now. It's also the expectation, which also is very good. And it's how high markets have come in terms of valuations. So whether or not we see the actual fundamentals of what we're going to be told are the earnings and the outlook, and how they compare with the current valuations, will all determine how markets will react, how individual securities will react. You have to remember that while the game, of course, is to provide analysts with information and estimates ongoing throughout the various quarters, companies will usually guide them a little bit lower in order to beat by a penny, 2 pennies, 5 cents, and beat on revenues as well. But there's a big wild card right now. We have a couple of things that are going on right now in particular that are confusing, I think, in terms of what analysts are going to expect, because I think companies don't really have a handle either on what is the actual net effect. Sure, they're crunching numbers. They're going through all the things that they go through to figure out how their earnings are going to play out with regard to these two items, which is number one, taxes and the new tax reform. And number two, what is the impact of the U.S. dollar's weakness on their company? Now, we know that for a long time when the dollar was rising, we saw that this was a significant headwind to earnings. And of course, that is something that is understandable. Clearly, there's no question about that. And what we're finding now is as the dollar is coming down significantly over the last year, that there is an amazing amount of tailwind that goes on there, particularly for those companies and many of those major multinationals. We've talked about this a few times. And what we're seeing right now is that this is definitely, unquestionably, a real benefit to the bottom line for many of these companies. But we'll see how long that lasts, because it is all cyclical. One of the reasons that we're seeing the dollar drop, which you would think for a second, if you stopped and stepped back and wondered, hey, what should the dollar be doing in this kind of environment? Well, what really impacts the dollar? You have things like the economic backdrop and strength, the political stability of a country. You have rates. You have inflation. So what we're seeing right now, you would think, is not exactly aligned with a lot of the different inputs that go into the potential valuation of a currency. So the United States, we have a very strong backdrop and outlook for the economics. We also have a Fed that looks like they're going to be increasing rates over time. We have a market that's very strong. So what's going on? Well, I think really what's happening is it's a play against other currencies that seem to be overdone on the downside, really picking up. For example, look at the euro. Look at the yen. These two countries are actually seeing better and much better than expected economic growth of late. And as their quantitative and stimulus programs, the quantitative easing and stimulus programs have really done a number on their currency for some time, what's happening now is the trade that was to short the yen and to short the euro against the dollar and against other currencies is starting to get unwound. And the dollar's caught in that. Even though the U.S. economy is strong, the strength of the economics in Japan and what they've talked about, we saw recently that the Central Bank of Japan and the Central Bank of Europe started talking about possibly slowing down some of their bond purchases, a conversation that they've been trying to wade into. Of course, they go back and forth, but they've definitely been talking more about slowing down their purchases or their potential. And that has been having a major effect on their currencies. And of course, as we know, currencies trade in a pair, right? You have, currencies don't trade on their own. It's always against another currency. So you look at the US dollar versus the yen, the US dollar versus the euro, the dollar versus the peso, the yen versus the euro, and just on and on. So what's happening really right now is more so that these other currencies are rising much more than we see them, the U.S. dollar necessarily falling because some of the backdrop of the U.S. is strong. But it's they were so far overdone and the trade was be long the dollar and be short these other currencies. And now that's just being turned around. And that's having a great effect on our companies here. And that's good. That's good news. No question about that. So when we look at this, we really have to consider the fact that it's not just in a vacuum when we consider currencies and we consider what's happening. Because if you did that, the dollar would probably be at least level. So that's a big issue. Now I want to kind of do a little bit of housekeeping here just for a moment and tell you and thank you, by the way, for all the kind reviews that you gave. I put up that new area on thedisciplinedinvestor.com where you can go and actually put a podcast review. And then what we did was we posted them to the site. So you can see all the different reviews there. If you haven't done so, I really would appreciate spending just a couple of minutes going over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, clicking on the podcast button on the top, and it will drop down. It will say podcast reviews. And you can submit a review that way. You can see what people said, but also submit a review. Some very kind things. I really appreciate that, especially for those who have been listening for years and years and years. You know, this is not one of those podcasts that's popped up over the last couple of months. We've had some unbelievable guests too over the time, and we're going to have a lot more coming up. As a matter of fact, I got to get Frank Curzio on soon because he went to the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas recently. And he is going to have a lot to talk about because there were some really cool things that were revealed and some new and interesting updates in terms of electronics and some of the companies that they that are putting these out. So we're going to talk about that as well. Also, I'll mention, if you would be so kind to retweet once you get this and you see that the podcast is up, just retweet it. Send it out to your friends and your family. On Facebook, share it. Every time a podcast is posted, we make sure it goes on Twitter. We make sure it immediately goes on Facebook. You know, share that. Send it out to some others. It's really something I do appreciate. Our quarterly newsletter or write-up, our economic commentary and review will be out probably by the end of this week. We're talking about mean reversion and the whole aspect of what's going on and kind of identifying the value versus growth play that we've talked about before here. And also, we're talking about the Citigroup surprise, economic surprise index. It's going to be kind of interesting and a few other things. But we'll have those available as well. We usually put them out for clients first, and then we'll make sure to have those available for our listeners as well. While we're talking about a few things here, I just got to mention, of course, that we have a new sponsor. That's FreshBooks. You may have heard of them before. And it's a really cool product. You got to think about your day if you're self-employed and you're kind of, just really busy, right? And you're working on a few different projects. You could be prepping for a meeting. And you're trying to get through all this paperwork. And you want to think about, well, what am I going to do about billing? Well, welcome to life as a self-employed individual, right? It's challenging. There's no question about that. But you know what? Our friends at Facebook believe the rewards are worth it. And we know that, we've seen this. We've seen the working world has changed dramatically over the last number of years. Growth of the internet has been, creating incredible opportunities for individuals that are self-employed. And what FreshBooks did and what they do is they've launched an all-new version of their cloud accounting software. This is really some neat stuff because it's really easy to use. That's really the whole nuts and bolts of this. It's been redesigned from the ground up and it's custom built to give you the things that you need to get through your day, track projects, do invoicing, collect on credit cards, look at your accounts receivable, your P&L, what things you have to do in terms of your projects. So it's really easy because I went through this and did this actually. You can create and send really professional looking invoices in less than 30 seconds, set up online payments and see when your clients have paid you and just track everything. The good news is you get a 30-day free trial. It's unrestricted. All you have to do is go to freshbooks.com/TDI and enter the Disciplined Investor in the How Do You Hear About Us box and you get a full working version for 30 days. So if you've been thinking of, what can I do to streamline my business? Check this out, freshbooks.com/TDI. Now, for all the talk that we've had recently about interest rates and just discussed the dollar, I thought it'd be really cool to bring on someone who was a Fed insider. And we talked to Danielle DiMartino Booth in the past, but I really wanted to get some more insight because there seems to be a change that is a brewing in the various central banks. Some of the commentary, we know that Jerome Powell is going to be taking over the reins very shortly. And there's, some question about, well, what does that mean? And how is that going to reshape the communication process and actually what the Fed is doing in line with their dual mandate? And of course, we know that dual mandate kind of slides around a little bit in terms of their inflation targeting and their employment. But this is something I think it's really important to get down and dirty with because we need to understand this because it's been a big driver, whatever you want to say, it's been a big driver of the market. So I'll tell you why. Now we could talk about, earnings. Well, of course, earnings are doing better. We have a very low interest rate. We know buybacks have been a big part. Why? We have very low interest rates. We know that the dollar has been ticking down for some time, then ticking back up, and now it came back down again, and that has a bit to do with the Fed. But a lot of the safety net underneath a lot of this is due to the massive amount of liquidity and stimulus that central banks have provided over the last number of years. So let's get it on and find out really what's going on and what the outlook is. And today we're talking with Danielle DiMartino Booth, who is said to be a global thought leader, which we're going to find out more about, on monetary policy and economics. And she's the author of the wonderful book, Fed Up, An Insider's Take on Why the Federal Reserve is Bad for America. You can get your copy anywhere. It's available all over the place. Actually rose up to the bestseller list for a while there. She's also a regular writer on all topics dedicated to markets and the Fed and also to monetary policy. She's been publishing a letter for the last 132 consecutive weeks, which is pretty amazing. And she also spent 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, where she served as advisor to President Richard Fisher until he retired in March of 2015. So I have a lot of questions to ask you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm pretty good, thanks. I've seen you got lots of TV exposure lately.
Well, there's lots to talk about. You know, there's a whole changing of the guard at the Federal Reserve. So lots of things going on as we enter the great recovery, as I'm starting to call it.
Yeah. When did that start?
Well, actually, that's what I'm going to write about this upcoming week, is the great recovery, because that is what the majority of economists believe that we're on the cusp of enjoying, is the great recovery.
I mean, it seems to me that, you know, we have a relatively stable economic backdrop here in the U.S. and everywhere else. I mean, there's a couple of spots, maybe not, but around the world, there's a pretty good economic backdrop. You know, whether or not we want to say that, oh, the Fed and the central banks around the world, through their very easy monetary policy, has done a really good job at reflating, you know, certain assets, maybe not all the way trickled down, but reflating assets and now keeping their rates extremely low in the face of the fact that we're, you know, recovering has done a great job. Then we add on top of that this tax cut that we're seeing for corporations in the U.S. Do you think that was necessary?
Necessary. You know, taking these measures when the economy's not at DEFCON 1, you know, what was necessary about the tax cuts was simplifying the tax code and making American corporations on a global stage much more competitive than what we had become. It didn't accomplish very much of that. There's been no simplification. And not as many companies as we would hope will be benefiting, and they left all the loopholes in there. So you know, bigger picture is the Federal Reserve can offset a lot of the stimulus that will occur initially. The sugar high from the tax cuts, if you will, in 2018 can be largely offset by Federal Reserve policy.
Yeah, and because obviously with the projected rate hikes and that having the impact of draining liquidity from the system and actually essentially bringing down stimulus, whether it's because of slowing down their bond purchases, right, and or raising rates. So if it didn't have the desired impact of, well, let's just get back to that. So why was the tax code then done? Why was the tax reform done then?
Well, because the Republicans, and this is a nonpartisan statement on my part, the Republicans absolutely had to get legislation in some form passed to have a snowball's chance in hell at the upcoming midterm elections. That's just math.
Yeah.
That's math.
Right. So now we have this lower tax rate that really skewed towards benefiting corporations. I think we agree with that, right? That's nothing. I mean, that's pretty much out there.
Oh, there's nothing. No, I mean, there will be a little bit of benefit to the middle class. But if you talk to a small business owner, again, because a lot of these loopholes were not closed, a lot of these things are offsetting factors in the new tax bill. So this really is going to help kind of the big banks, energy, certain specific large sectors.
So with that, I've been thinking about this. Okay, so now we've made our corporations more competitive from a tax standpoint, right? And did some repatriation requirements on them. I was wondering, what do you think about this? And I'm starting to, I don't know, I'm starting to see some glimpses of this. Is there a chance that we're going to see a global tax war start to heat up?
Global tax war, I'm not so certain about. You could theoretically have, you know, the Irelands of the world take umbrance with our being more competitive. I certainly don't think they want to see all this repatriation that's being predicted. I think they'd rather have all of those trillions of dollars in their coffers. But tax wars are a little bit more difficult to engage in vis-a-vis currency wars.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. Well, there's a lot more. Currency wars is kind of a flick of a button and maybe even a conversation by someone in charge that talks down their currency or talks it up or, you know, does something to drain something or to put capital controls on, right? Whereas it takes legislation to do tax reform.
Exactly. And sometimes if you sit down and study individual individual countries and how they legislate in their given economy, you're like, wow, I thought the United States was complicated. Katie, bar the door. How do they get anything done?
Yeah. So we're in this global recovery. Tell me what that means.
That means that if you, the simplest way to look at it is to look at the PMIs of individual countries. And, you know, outside of South Africa, literally outside of South Africa, every major economy in the world right now is in a reflating mode. And that's intuitive because we have just come off of a record year in 2017 of global quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. We had $2 trillion in global QE in 2017, which was a higher figure than at any point, even during the darkest days of QE infinity, if you remember that, mm-hmm. when the Fed had the full pedal to the metal. So there's been a lot of impetus to borrow and spend worldwide, and that has done a lot to reinvigorate the supply chains around the world.
Now, do you see a problem with the fact that since the cratering of the financial system around the world, but of course here in the U.S., where we saw that basically there was an obliteration of assets, that there was this requirement for essentially a transfer of debt from the books of individuals, corporations to countries, governments, right? That's kind of what happened, right? We took the bad debt, they bought debt, and now we have a lot more debt on the books of governments or central banks, which whether that is part of the government or not is another whole discussion. But when corporations fail, when individuals fail, obviously they can go next up and there'll be an offset of who takes over the debt, and then it goes further from there. Now, what happens when there is such an incredible amount of debt on the books of countries? Where do they go if there is some kind of situation that happens where all of a sudden maybe rates rock up really hard, or I don't know, something? Where do they go next? I mean, the only thing I can think of is God. I mean, that's the only one that could save them at that point, right? What's going
to
happen?
Right, and you and I actually have the same dark sense of humor, that they'd have to go knocking on St. Peter's gate and ask God to whip out his checkbook.
Yeah, I mean, how is this going to play out?
On a practical level, if you ask any of the central bankers of the world who are convinced that they can control the world regardless of what is thrown at them, they will tell you that a full-blown, coordinated, global monetization of the debt would be the next step in order to prevent any kind of conflagration like what you're suggesting, when, oh my gosh, there's nobody who's got liquidity who can write a big enough check. So their answer is a full-blown, outright monetization of the debt that is agreed upon by the major debtors of the world. Wow. Scares the hell out of me.
Wow. Interesting. So when it comes to Federal Reserve, talk to me a little bit, a fly on the wall, where you know, tell us about what was it like working in the Fed? Was there a lot of guesswork? Was there a lot of, everybody was just, you know, believers and drones walking around kind of, okay, yes, that's whatever's sent down. That's what they believe. I mean, what's it like there?
Well, speaking of God, there was definitely a lot of faith inside the walls of the Federal Reserve. You know, Bernanke is saying, you know, this is 2006, 2007. Bernanke is saying, you know, there's never been a nationwide decline in housing prices since the Great Depression. Ergo, it can never happen. And I'm like, but we've been around for longer than the 1920s and 30s. And we can look back further than that with panics and outright decline. So why can't we have another one? Just because we haven't in 80 years, it made absolutely no sense to me. But you are correct. There was a lot of blind faith going on inside those walls. Given Janet Yellen's the last few speeches she made in public as head of the Fed, and her statement that we will never see another financial crisis in our lifetimes. I mean, if that's the latest flavor of Kool-Aid that they're drinking, God help us.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there's something else that's been really bothering me. So if you recall back in the days when there was targets for the unemployment rate, you know, we were at somewhere about, when the unemployment rate gets to 5.5% or whatever the exact number was at the time, we're going to slow down on our stimulus efforts. And then somehow that got changed to, oh, it's five. We're here. We're going to drop it down to five because we still see some slack in the labor markets. And kind of I lost a little confidence with that. But okay, I have a real serious concern that this 2% inflation target, which, by the way, somehow has been adopted by other countries as well, is this arbitrary number. I mean, what is the importance of 2% inflation before we, you know, see any kind of real significant normalization?
Well, now, there are very few areas where Alan Greenspan and I see eye to eye. But several years ago, in the transcripts, there was a big debate, and the Ben Bernankes and the Janet Yellens of the world really did want to implement a 2% inflation rate target, to which Greenspan said, the ideal inflation rate in this world is zero. If you want a target, fine, I'll give it to you. Zero. Never set an inflation rate target. It will back you into a corner, and it will cause egregious errors in policymaking into the future. And guess what?
Yep.
The Fed has backed itself into a corner. And when you look at Kuroda in Japan saying, we're going to get there, we're going to get there, you're like, how many decades of faith are you going to keep? Do you have that you're finally going to get there? My point is, it's arbitrary and it's destructive at the same time.
I never understood this 2% number. And while I could be persuaded if one particular central bank in one country had a 2%, and let's say Japan maybe had 1.75 or 2.2 or whatever, something different, you know, that looked like that, okay, for our country, for our levels, we want to do this. And the funny thing is that while we're all sitting there going, yeah, yeah, 2%, we have to reach 2%, yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's funny because we know that the inflation numbers are, when we see that there is inflation, like, for example, I would assume that the next inflation numbers that come out next week, we may see that, what we may see is that there's a little bit hotter inflation due to the fact that we've seen some energy prices spike. But I am so certain that they'll be called transitory by the Fed that they're not worried about that and try to look beyond that. They're so afraid to get us back to a normalized a rate. And it's very frustrating. I don't necessarily want.
But to your point, that's what makes it so arbitrary. What's the difference between 1.8 and 2%? If there are plenty of pockets of inflation, because there's nothing transitory about Joe Q and Jane Q who are living paycheck to paycheck, who are not going out to Applebee's for dinner on Friday night because it's costing them more on a monthly basis to fill up their gas tank. Mm-hmm. There's nothing arbitrary about that. It's a change of lifestyle, and there's nothing transitory about it.
I agree. And then, of course, many of the things that are not taken into consideration in the inflation that costs us all a lot of money as well, additional. So I think I saw you somewhere talk about that you did some calculations on how much of an impact a 0.25% or a 0.5% rate hike means to the economy and how much it draws out of the economy. And how there's going to be, and then zeroed in on how that offsets the tax plan.
Absolutely. Yeah. And look, if you look at what kind of the median, middle of the road expectations are for an economic boost in 2018, thanks to the tax cuts, you'll get to somewhere in the neighborhood of $80 to $100 billion. Corporate earnings are expected to be boosted by about $100 billion by these tax cuts. For every quarter percentage point rate hike by the Fed, there's a $50 billion sucking sound that we hear coming out of GDP. So all you really need in 2018 are two rate hikes to effectively offset the entire benefit of the tax cuts to GDP, to economic growth. And that isn't even bringing into the conversation the fact that the Fed is engaging in quantitative tightening in the background by shrinking its balance sheet, which is in and of itself a separate form of monetary tightening.
So just to talk about the GDP now, that's another number that everybody seems to be stuck on, this 3% number. You know, it seems to me that when you get to be a developed country and, you know, I remember back when Dell Computer the stock kept on going up and up and up because everybody was buying Dell computers. You know, it was the beginning of the PC boom, right? And the stock was just going up and up. And then somebody did a calculation, says, you know what? If this stock it continues on its growth path of, let's call it, you know, 25% of growth on earnings and revenue a year, everybody's going to have like 12 PCs on their desktop in order to meet these numbers. And it seems to me that the GDP is similar, that, you know, 2.5% or so for a developed country doesn't seem to be the worst thing in the world to me. But they're so concerned about getting back to 3% to 4% or whatever the number is that, you know, I just don't really understand where that is also a number that is being stoked around as really the important number to hit.
Well, you know what? It's a lot of this is politicking and optics, right? People, the politicians of the world want to be able to go into the midterm elections and say, you know, we have, after 10 years of 2%, we've created 12 months of 3%. Mm. It optically, it looks a lot better. It really does. And I mean, you know, who knew that the Republicans, and again, this is not a partisan statement on my behalf. You lose one more senator to retirement, and it's going to flip regardless.
Yeah.
If it's not replaced by a Republican. Again, this is just simple math in the Senate and in the House. But who knew that they should wake up and thank their lucky stars the day that Hurricane Harvey made landfall, and that they should be, you know, pounding the table when Irma hit, and having a flat out party when the wildfires broke out on the West Coast and Maria shellacked Puerto Rico, because that is what at the margin has created this 3% growth rate that will probably continue through the first quarter and keep the Federal Reserve on a tighter tightening path than it would be otherwise, because we had these magnificent natural disasters that created the impetus to, I mean, lumber, truckers, you name it. The rebuilding effort is unprecedented when you consider that the only thing that we have to compare it to, historically speaking, is Hurricane Katrina.
You know, it's funny I had this discussion.
Economic growth.
I had this discussion and everybody's like, well, oh my, we have all these horrible things that are happening. I got all these emails saying, oh, terrible. You know, it's really going to be a problem for the economy and all this. And I said, you know, think about this for a second. Yes, it is a momentary problem when everybody is worrying about, oh my gosh, you know, this whole area shut down, nobody's working. So you have whatever time period that is, 2 to 3 weeks, 4 weeks till they start to get things going. But the backside of this, particularly when you have a very, you know, fires, for example. I mean, fire is a great example. It just burns down the house. You have to rebuild from the ground up. It's not just a repair, you know, and this actually pushes in a dramatic amount of construction building, jobs that will move down there. There'll be a gigantic transfer of money from insurance companies and FEMA to individuals. And this will create a very interesting short-term economic boom in those areas that will feed back into the rest of the economy, providing for a really nice number on GDP, either locally or spread out. And they're like, oh, I never thought of it that way. I mean, these natural disasters are actually, why do you think we had such, you know, good boom during war times? I mean, you have to do this money coming into the system to do stuff.
Of course there is. And there are, you know, if you think about the rebuilding effort in Europe and the Marshall Plan. But look, by the same token, what the other people, the other thing that I don't think most, and look, I am typically a glasses half empty kind of a girl, and I'm the biggest cheerleader right now I know. This is a complete Shirley MacLaine full-blown out-of-body experience I'm having. This is bizarre for me. But again, people, it's just adding up the dollars and cents. And I say cents, S-E-N-S-E. 2017 was supposed to be the year of the magnificent, great, wonderful, strong dollar. Well, it wasn't.
That was weird.
So it was weird, but the boon to manufacturers on top of all these natural disasters, again, just add it up. Our exports are more competitive on the global stage. Ergo, we sell more of them. Period. End.
Why did the dollar drop as much as it did? I mean, it seemed that we had a lot of things going for it with starting with, even before elections and all that, we had issues regarding increase of rates by the Fed and tightening. That should have done well. We had good manufacturing and a good backdrop economically. That should bring the dollar higher. You need all the ingredients into this. And then seemingly the tax code was, you know, passed and a few other things didn't. But yet the dollar, I don't know if the dollar's telling us something, by the way, you know, because usually you have a weakening dollar in a weakening economic backdrop. I don't know what's going on. Why are we, is it really just the European situation?
Now I'm going to play down.
Okay.
Devil's advocate. State 50, a bloodbath in retail. Mm-hmm. All kinds of store closures. Before Hurricane Harvey hit, on a year-over-year basis, we were in a recession in the automobile industry.
Right.
The consumer sector was starting to reflect that year-over-year recession in the automobile industry, with back-to-back-to-back increases in subprime auto delinquencies, which, by the way, has continued in the background unchecked. Month after month after month, these delinquencies continue to get worse, and credit card loss provisions have continued to build as well. We just had a great discussion about the fact that all of this rebuilding effort was going to create genuine economic output. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's no disputing that. And the fact that manufacturers have done well, I mean, the most recent Chicago Purchasing Managers Index was blockbuster. It was huge. Mm-hmm. But by that same token, there are a lot of people who are making less money or who have lost their jobs in retail. If you're not in a trade where vocational training has fallen off the map for two generations, and therefore you can charge whatever you want, because that is true pricing power when it comes to demanding what you want for wages. Because people have not been, you know, flocking by the millions to attend truck driving school. So if you're a truck driver today, you name your price. Period end. If you're a welder, if you're a general contractor, you can name your price. If you're not in one of these industries, good luck. And that is the part of the U.S. household sector that is suffering. That is why FHA mortgages are nearing a 10% delinquency rate. Still waters run deep. That's one of my favorite sayings. And we have a very buoyant, robust, strong economy right now on the face of it, but underneath the surface, things continue to weaken for the other half of Americans who have absolutely no pricing power when it comes to what their paycheck is going to reveal.
And is this a situation that has been that has changed? In other words, the underlying weakness, is that something that has been ongoing forever, or is that just the last few years?
It's, well, look, if you, the most brilliant chart that I put in a newsletter recently was something, of course it didn't happen in one of our investment banks. It came from overseas, but they compared all the developed world's labor force participation rates, you know, the percentage of their population that is in the workforce. Mm-hmm. They compared it across 30 developed economies. The only economy in that group, the only exception that has had two subsequent decades, back-to-back decades of a declining labor force participation rate is the United States of America, period, end.
Is that because of an aging population?
No, it's not a demographic story. Not. It's going to become a demographic story, but it certainly wasn't a demographic story. No, this is multiple generations of feckless politicians who have not right-sized and reformed our education system such that we have fallen behind as a nation in STEM education, in educating our own engineers. We have, as I mentioned earlier, let vocational training go by the wayside. So Germany continues to kick our ass when it comes to moving up the value added chain in manufacturing. And China has continued to build out its own manufacturing capabilities. It's not that we're not manufacturing as a country. It's that we're not growing our manufacturing sector holistically, internally, with our own graduates from our own graduate schools.
Right. Yeah, that's crazy.
So this is what you pay long term because you leave your education system behind and you let the central bankers of the world do your job as politicians and keep easy money flowing so that you constantly have this illusion of economic growth.
And break it up, a little breaking up there, kind of crazy little connection here. But
their boom periods follow as I increase the amount of debt. And I'm sorry, I apologize. But my point is, We've had to generate increased amounts of debt, incremental dollar of economic output in this country, and that is why competitively speaking, we have been left behind as a country. It really doesn't have that much to do with our tax code, which is where we started this discussion.
Right, exactly.
Where can people find information that you are espousing?
Hop on a trial membership. Trial membership. It's the beginning of the year. I just came back from the gym. Hop on a trial subscription, I should say. Go to demartinobooth.com and come follow me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. At DiMartino Booth. It's never boring, always exciting. But again, try a trial subscription. I write about these subjects every single week. It is my life's goal to be contrarian.
Oh, there you go. Well, I appreciate it, and always refreshing and interesting and actually educational. So there's good stuff there. I appreciate you coming aboard.
I look forward to coming on again. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Bye.
That was a good talk. Gotta really appreciate some of the inside scoop that she brings as a former Fed insider. And I thought it was really interesting about the discussion, how we've had probably the most in a recent history, most amount of actual global stimulus, coordinated stimulus in the markets in 2017. I guess that makes a good deal of sense when it comes to thinking about how markets have reacted recently to any kind of downstroke when you have such an incredible amount of liquidity that is involved in markets. There's no wonder why you see things happening as they are. And, you know, the continuation of things like the recovery in the housing sectors, Case-Shiller housing price index, still seeing nice growth on a year-over-year basis. And we're seeing that there's new businesses that are popping up and a lot of M&A activity, merger and acquisition activity that's been going on. A lot of this is, again, thanks to a very inexpensive funding through low interest rates. I was wondering, by the way, I've been reading an interesting book on, call it market psychology or trading psychology or just general psychology, that written by Denise Schull. We had her on as a guest some time ago. And I was wondering, you know, if you have any really good books that you've been reading or that you've read recently, I mean, really good, something outstanding, do me a favor, send me a note on it. Just pop it in the Ask Andrew section. Maybe we'll start a little book club going on here or you know, tweet it to me. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter handle over there. So you could just get it to me somehow and I'll try to check it out. But again, if you really read something really interesting related to markets, economies, world, or global finance that you really thought was just, wow, that was, you know, that really changed something in my thinking. Or that really was, eye-opening in terms of some of the concepts that they talk about. Get it over to me. I'd like to know about it. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is, you know, if you think about it for a second, there's a lot of, listen, all of us have some degree of confirmation bias. This is where we look at the things that we want to see and we really highlight them. It's very easy for our eyes to go to something that we say, yeah, I agree with that. Let me see more about that. So if you're really positive on the markets or negative, or if you really have one political view that you want to, that you hold on to, you may see an article that comes up and you say, oh yeah, that guy's right. And you click on the headline, you read it, but the other stuff you just ignore. This is confirmation bias. You're looking for confirmation of your particular stance that something is true. And it can be in all sorts of areas of life. But when we talk about it in the markets, it's where you're thinking, yeah, markets are overvalued. You know, oh, there's an article on markets being overvalued. I'm going to read that one. Versus the article that says, hey, markets have a lot more room to run. You just, no, that can't be right. I'm going to leave that alone. When we deal with this and we do it to a degree that is a bit to the level of excess, what's going to happen? Well, our thinking is going to stay the same. And you're going to keep on looking for reasons and rationales and ways to say, yeah, I was right, even if you're wrong. So reading books or quality articles, and especially those that maybe you don't necessarily agree with, but have something to teach us, something to let us in on, some information that maybe we could use, helps us. in a time where it's so much easier just to watch something on TV or YouTube or just read the headlines, I think it's even more important because those that are writing the headlines or the YouTube videos or the short blog posts, I think, are onto this. They know that they have to write a really good headline to get your attention because seemingly our attention span has diminished the more we use things like the internet where we can get information not only 24/7, but instantaneously on any subject. You don't have to do too much research to get base information. The question is it good information? Is it just confirming your particular bias? So for the new year, what I ask you to do is pick up a book that maybe, not so much what you necessarily would agree with or an area that you really haven't focused on to bring in a different perspective. To let you see maybe what the other side says. So maybe you are all about Momo and growth and trading stocks that have, you know, a lot of juice behind them, technology and healthcare and biotechs. Well, maybe pick up a book on value investing, or maybe look at some of the old line discussions and articles by a Warren Buffett. Get the other side, get the information that can give you a much greater breadth of education and also open your eyes into other aspects of ways in which that you can become much more profitable in your investing, in your trading, and possibly less closed off to other ideas. Just a thought. But again, if you have any good books, outstanding, excellent, top-notch, that you've read recently that really was just something special, send it over to me. I'd really appreciate finding out more about that, and we'll see if we can highlight that. Maybe even get the authors on, because that's what I like to do. I like to get their books and get them on, talk to them, find out what they have to say, read their books. Kind of a cool process. That's what we do here. That's what it's all about, right? So I get the inside scoop because I get both sides of it as well. I get education because I get to speak with the authors, find out more about them, read their books, and then talk to them. And you get the same because it's obviously we record it and send it out. So that's what this whole business of this show is all about. And hopefully you've found that as well. All right, we're going to end on this holiday shortened week coming up on a little bit of a shorter show today. Not much shorter, but a little bit. Please do me a favor. Last week, we didn't have the stream up. Something happened there. But on Tuesday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern, myself and John C. Dvorak, we talk about the other side of business. We talk about some of the things and try to deconstruct what really is going on below and beneath the headlines and the basic information. Sometimes you talk about some screwy things, but oftentimes we'll bring you market updates and really an in-depth look at some of the other items. We play some games. We talk about the Close to the Pin competition. We have a weekly stock picks that actually on dhunplugged.com, you can find what's going on there, what our stock picks are doing. Lots of really good stuff there. dhunplugged.com on Tuesday evenings with a live chat room where you can chime in and be a part of the whole conversation as well. Other than that, I'm not sure what else I have here. Hopefully you're on the Investology update list. We sent something out recently, getting some really great feedback on our advisor-crafted technology-enhanced solution that's kind of not like your old-fashioned robo, but kind of the new version of how it works to have a semi-do-it-yourself and manage portfolio at the same time. Investology with an E. Envestology, investology.com. All right, we'll talk to you again next week. I hope you have a great one. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.